Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church. Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm producer Caleb, and I'm joined by our host, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Today, we're still in our new topic of apologetics. We're having kind of a break from all the guests we had. If you've been listening to the show, we had we started in Lochi topics, topics of theology for the beginning of our show, and then between that and this new apologetic series, we had probably 10 guest episodes in there.
What, a 10?
I think it was a lot, if you count everything sprinkled in the Lochi, and then it was at least 4 or 5 other ones just in between these two episodes. So I guess we had some repeat guests. We had Elise Fitzpatrick on a couple times. But that was exciting, and if you've been listening along, we're now in our apologetics series. We've done a couple episodes introducing the topic of apologetics. It's something that can't just be isolated to one episode, I think. We tried to get, 3 weeks ago, if you've been listening, we tried to encapsulate everything into one episode, but 40 minutes really isn't enough to completely introduce all the intricacies that go along with apologetics, especially if this is a new topic to you, if you haven't engaged in the task of apologetics before. And so over the last couple of weeks, we did a do's and don'ts episode when it comes to apologetics, and we did an introduction to apologetic topics. So this week, we're going to continue along that kind of introductory path, and we're going to pick up with an epistemology episode, kind of how we know what we know. And the fellows are going to lay out the groundwork of this and why knowing and the way we get our knowledge is going to be important to the task of apologetics. In fact, it's essential to understand how you know your world and how the people you're going to be engaging with apologetically understand their world. So, Dr. Keith, you want to introduce us to the episode?
Sure. Like Caleb said, we'll be talking a little bit about epistemology today, and specifically theological epistemology. How do we know those things to be true that our theology proclaims? We'll get into that in a minute, but I thought it might be helpful if one of either Rod or Adam could help us out and just tell the listeners, what is epistemology specifically? Caleb alluded to it, but if you were to just kind of give a definition of epistemology, how would you do that? What would you say?
Well, in a thumbnail sort of way, it's the chapter in any intro to Phil textbook on what do I know, or how do I know what I think I know. And there are a half a dozen or 8 in the history of the West answers to that.
Adam?
I don't know what else to add. Theory of knowledge.
Great. Yeah.
Episteme, the Greek word for knowledge. Ology, the study of. It's theoretical. At the same time, it's also very practical. Everybody has an epistemology, whether they recognize it or not.
Yep.
Some people have multiple epistemologies. They use one when they're thinking about mathematics or maybe, let's say, laboratory work. But when it comes to whether this is right or wrong, we'll probably talk about this a bit. When it comes to religious questions, they use an entirely different epistemology.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rarely are people, especially in our so-called postmodern world, rarely are people consistent in their epistemology. It's almost like an epistemology is embraced after the fact.
Yeah.
You know?
So, well, most of us do it without knowing the word. Yeah. You know, but there's something operating in us daily, some sort of epistemology, whether we know it or not.
Right. when I do this, this is the when I teach core theology at the university, the first set of classes I do is this epistemology of theology class. And I start out with a picture on the board that's sort of a diagram of epistemology. And I really like it for the visual impact because it helps the students realize, number one, kind of what Adam said, is that everybody's got an epistemology operating in the background, and maybe multiple epistemologies operating in the background. But two, as it defines the term, it acknowledges that when we deal with how do we, you know, epistemology functionally, that oftentimes it's asking two separate questions. It's asking, on the one hand, what is knowledge? And on the second hand, can we have knowledge? Mm-hmm. It's that second answer that I think is interesting when it comes to theology. Can we have knowledge? Can we have theological knowledge? And by that, I'd say, can we have theological knowledge that can be trusted as actually true, not just theologically true, not just spiritually true, but actually true, which then begs the second question. If we can have that type of knowledge, the really important question is, great, how do I get it, right? Mm-hmm. How do I get that knowledge?
Mm-hmm. The classic collision here was probably John Henry Cardinal Newman, and the book was The Idea of a University. And what he was up against as a convert to the Roman Catholic Church, what he was up against was defending to any and all universities that there was such a thing as religious right. knowledge.
Right.
That's been the basic book.
Right, yeah, and the students actually read the chapter on why theology should be included at the university, and they read that at the same time we're doing this, and it's good because at the end of the day, what Newman purports is that the university's job is to teach universal knowledge, and as a function of that job, it has to teach theology because this is one theology asks and answers some of the most universal questions.
Yep.
You know, why am I here? Where am I going? Is there purpose to my life? That type of thing. Starting there, and as a background for me, when we're discussing apologetics, we can say, like we did in the last couple weeks, that apologetics is the intellectual side of evangelism or the intellectual side of missions. But what we're saying, really, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, is that apologetics helps us not only decide but defend what we know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's stuff that we know in a real way, theologically. Is that accurate?
Sure, I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm. All right. So where would we go from here on this? How do we come about gaining some sort of real theological knowledge or epistemology?
Well, many people would say, don't start with religious knowledge. Start with any kind of knowledge. You can work your way to religious knowledge. But first of all, how do we know anything we think we know?
That's perfect. Yeah. That's typically when we do this in classes, that's what I do. And I try, first of all, to say, like Adam was alluding to at the beginning, to say, listen, you operate with one of these systems or structures or multiple structures. You may not realize it. And it's kind of fun. What I have them do right out of the gate is write down just on a piece of paper, make two columns on the left-hand column, write down a particular source that they trust to help guide them in making very important but probably everyday types of decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And on the right-hand side, say, why do you trust that source?
Right.
And what's revealed out of that oftentimes is their actual epistemology, mm-hmm. you know, what's going on
mm-hmm.
there. But it's hard because we live in an age where there's some conflict going on. It's oftentimes called postmodernism, and I'm not enough of an expert on it to ever discuss like when it began and all that. Maybe Adam can help us out with that. But I mean, the idea that we're coming into discovering how we find truth, looking into how we find truth, that's difficult in our age. I mean, truth isn't really something that's understood, you know, as a broader term that means something is sort of universally true. It's oftentimes now understood in a very subjective way.
Mm-hmm. There's been you refer to postmodernism. I don't know if it's the big culprit, but there has been a turn philosophically in the Western world for some time away from an assumption, you might call it a worldview assumption of realism, that there's a world outside of your head and that you can know that world. And we could all four of us sitting around this table, the realist assumption says that world's out there, it exists independent of our thoughts and the beliefs about it.
Good.
And all four of us could go out and investigate that world, and we might describe it a little differently. We might disagree on some of the particulars, but Laura, for the most part, we'd agree on that object outside of our head. You know, postmodernism, maybe some people would put it all the way back to the rise of more of a radical stream of nominalism that emerges late in the Middle Ages, says that if there is a world outside your head to know, you cannot know it objectively or in a universal sense, because bias or prejudice always is there. That world outside your brain, you at best, you can know particulars as they are, as you empirically encounter them, but once you are no longer in empirical contact with them, you no longer know it. There's all sorts of stuff going on in the Western philosophical tradition that militate against what we're getting after, or going after.
Right.
This notion that there's an object outside of our head that you can come to know or reason to.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to add, this is relatively new. That is, for centuries, way back pre-Christian and working forward into the millennium after, that was almost a universal assumption. They differed on the details, but the idea that there wasn't a world, let alone one that could be known, was sort of foreign to the ancients. Sometimes it's good, especially in philosophy, to say, this style of skepticism is relatively new on the board.
Right, yeah. And you put it to the late Middle Ages. That's as old as I've ever heard.
This is a thesis that's been out there for some time, that it's not necessarily, the door was cracked for this extreme skepticism with the more radical stream of nominalism, but it takes centuries for it to really reach its conclusion.
I want to ask you a side question, because when you're teaching this to students, and you know this better than I do, it's difficult to explain to them exactly what Rod was trying to get across, that this view of knowing, or rather not knowing, hasn't always been the case. And I try to explain to them that it gained prevalence, I think, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, I'd like to stop teaching it, because of some things that occurred in Europe that were absolutely devastating culturally, and what I'm talking about, massive wars that kill millions of people, and a perception that these wars were fought, you know, on the basis of some sort of grand, belief in grand narrative truth, and that we've had a rejection of that, but it started in Western Europe and, of course, coming over here.
Yeah. A lot of, I think it's Stephen Toulmin, has a book called Cosmopolis, where he traces the origin of the Enlightenment, if you will. And he says, right after the Thirty Years' War, 1648, Descartes, and so that's the rational side of things. Then you got the empiricist side of things. They're all looking to, if you will, construct systems of knowledge, but not on the basis of any sort of revelation, because revelation, they believed, is what was the cause of the 30 Years' War. So they're looking for more common, neutral ground from which to reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one I think to keep in mind, especially in the history of Western Phil, is that the ones we call the greats, almost every time we're going up against some form of radical skepticism where all knowledge was going to be lost. And you can trace that as a theme through the greats. Some new form of the loss of all knowledge, and they figured that was worth a fight.
Right.
You could trace, I mean, that's Socrates and Plato's context against the sophists.
Sure.
Where everything's just rhetoric, right?
Sure, right.
That's Plato's, the driving force of his epistemology is wanting to know what's really real.
Yep.
Adam, but this has gained, I mean, postmodernism now isn't even a philosophy as much as it's just kind of the way things are, the way people operate. I mean, if you walk up to the average millennial and say you're a postmodernist, they're going to go blank in the face and not know what the heck you're talking about. It's not as though they're sort of functioning.
It didn't come with labels.
Right. It's not as though they're sort of functioning with a systematized philosophy of postmodernism.
Well, a millennial, if you ask them to pump gas in their car, they're going to be clueless.
Well, that's true,
that.
Too.
Sorry.
Good dig, actually.
That, I like mean? It.
But, I mean, what do you I think that at some point we have to recognize that there was a dramatic shift in the way people thought after the World Wars, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
About, I mean, willingness to believe so much in a particular overarching idea that we'll send millions and millions and millions of people to die for it.
Yeah, one of the few things that Paul Tillich wrote that was true was when he said, there is no way I can get across to you what it was like to be living in Europe prior to the First World War. Mm. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't do it. And then came the First World War.
Right.
What couldn't happen because we'd evolved beyond
we'd
that.
Evolved yeah. far enough.
Yep.
Yeah. And then you went into, I mean, just mass killing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Years ago, between Strasbourg and Paris, a couple guys and I stopped off to see the Verdun battle site.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many were lost that day, but I think it approaches a million.
I think it does.
Over the course of a couple of days.
I think you're right.
Gosh. And the number of crosses and Jewish stars, and even there was a Muslim
crescent
cemetery there, yeah, is just staggering.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers, I don't know if any of the young generation have any idea of the sheer numbers.
Oh, no, yeah.
I remember one time that somebody told me that if you were at certain sites in France, you could turn over any block of dirt and probably find brass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and last year when we were in Strasbourg, we went and visited sites on the Maginot Line, and it's just shocking. Every site you go to, they tell you part of the story, and as the day progressed, by the end of the day, the story is just all I could think of, at least, is just the millions of men that gave their lives for, you know, for the ideas that they believed in.
Yeah.
And I think the only reason I brought that up really is because for our listeners, I want them to understand when we start talking about sort of loss of truth, sometimes capital T versus lower T truth, you know, loss of objective truth, that it's not as much of an accusation that we're making against a particular group of people for deciding to believe something as much as it is trying to get people to reframe the way they think about just sort of being plopped down in this current culture.
Yeah.
And to open their eyes a bit and say, look around, is there another option for viewing? Have I inherited something that was the result of things I don't even know about or remember?
Right.
And is there another way of looking at it? I think it's sometimes important to start there just for a sense of comfort in the conversation.
Right. And anybody who teaches Intro to Western Phil is going to have to say something to the students about this because it didn't begin 30 years ago. It began 4,000 years ago.
That's right. Right. So, Adam, you brought up in that conversation whether they're thinking rationally or empirically. And I think that's good because I think one of the next steps, and this is an oversimplification, and Rod's actually a philosopher, so he can call me out on this, is that...
Does he want to be called a philosopher?
Well, I don't know. But I've seen the degree path, so I think it works. Is that I try to tell people that, again, this sort of defining these way we think, it goes back thousands of years, right? And some of the original definitions placed on ways of thinking were rationalism and empiricism, or ways of viewing the world are rationalism and empiricism. To some degree, again, an oversimplification for the sake of brevity, you can think of the difference between Plato and Aristotle on some of this.
Yes.
But when I say that, and I'll actually tell the students or people, listen, you're probably, and I think I got this from you, Rod, I could be wrong, but I'll say you're probably hardwired one direction or the other with this. Mm-hmm. That you're sort of hardwired to view the world sort of from a rationalistic point of view or an empirical point of view. Mm-hmm. But if I say that, what am I talking about? What's rationalism? Just quick and dirty, what's rationalism?
Well, I suppose Descartes would be the classic example. It's the confidence that if you're doing clear, logical thinking, there's necessarily a match between it and how things are in the world. In other words, a really true system would not involve a whole bunch of contradictions,
right,
like Swiss cheese. It would be coherent or non-contradictory within itself.
Right.
But the primary emphasis is on the syllable of logical thinking. Mm-hmm. This was pre the development of science as it rolled in the 17th and 18th century. It has a longer history than that. But it's a confidence that our best guide to the question, what do we know, is to keep tight hold of logic.
Sometimes I'll say, if you're talking hard rationalism, I'll say it's the idea that you can acquire knowledge by reason without having to resort to your experience.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
The phrase you hear and you read in the English translation of Descartes is clear and distinct ideas.
Yes, right. There it is in the Meditations on First Philosophy.
And you test these ideas with other ideas, and whatever emerges as the clearest and the most distinct is probably true. That doesn't mean you don't keep testing it, but ideas are more important. They precede your actual real experience, your empirical experience.
Right.
And I think what Rob pointed out is important for the listeners to grab hold of, this idea that these ideas ought to be at least internally consistent. Right. Now, there's a plus and a minus to that, right?
There is to all of the positions.
There is to all of the positions. On the plus side, if your reasoning is clear, that's a good thing, obviously, right?
Sure.
The better the reasoning, hopefully the better the conclusion. On the downside, a position can be completely internally consistent and still be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Still not match reality.
Yep.
Be operating off of a broken premise.
Yep.
Or a premise that's incorrect.
Yep.
I mean, you can construct very clean, rationally deduced systems that are internally consistent that started with an idea, a premise that was wrong.
Yeah, the one that occurs to me, you probably have better examples, but the one that occurs to me is what the intellectual Marxists did over many, many, many decades. They almost had the thing where it was coherent, you know, non-contradictory within itself, and you say, yeah, but it's bats. And you'd be correct.
Right.
Because of what you mentioned.
Yeah,
there's a premise there that's a real problem.
There's no way this will actually work.
Well, man is not just homo economicus.
Right. Mm. Right.
In Oxford, I remember running into people who were Marxists, as you learn this as you talk to them, who, and when you bring up the critique, well, this has never really worked in real time and real space. And their response is, well, that's because it hasn't been implemented correctly.
Correctly.
I swear.
Or perfectly.
Yeah. Swear.
But there's the flawed premise, though, is it can't be implemented perfectly because people are imperfect. They're sinners.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, we're in election time, and a lot of the left wing is doing what the left wing always done. And at the same time, Venezuela is a paradigm case, and it's going on right now. And I'm sure the answer is, yeah, but they're not as smart as we are. We can do this. They were too stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Sam Harris, the new atheist,
in
his book, The End of Faith. After the first edition, he got all these responses that said, you dummy. I don't know if they actually said that. But you're proposing this sort of same stuff that they did in the 20th century, and it led to millions upon millions dead in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so his second edition, he's got an appendix of all the responses to all these questions or critiques he had. And one is, what makes your system of atheism different than the atheism of Lenin and, and Stalin and others. And it says the difference between the new atheism and that older style of atheism is that the new atheism is more rational.
Oh my God. Good Lord, deliver.
Never mind that in the book he says there might be a time at some point in the future where it's more rational and ethical to kill people who hold dangerous religious ideas.
That sounds very similar to the old atheism.
Yeah, you think? Yeah. He talks about a world government being necessary.
That'll
send
Heard that Rosenbaum. Before.
Oh, good grief.
All right, before we head to our break, just quick and dirty again. So we did rationalism. What's empiricism?
Well, down and dirty, empiricism is the view that you examine the world using your five senses, and that's how you get information about the world that exists outside of you. You make room for cases at the edges, you know. Is he on drugs? How is the lighting? The mirage on the road driving to light. You have to make room.
Exclude hyperbole.
Yeah. But basically, it's the one that makes science work. And the important thing, I think, in our day is to say, not just empiricism, but true empirical method.
Well, good.
That means it's open, not closed.
Right. So not hard empiricism.
Not the old hard empiricism where you can say before you even start, well, that's silly. Right. You don't get to do that.
Right.
Each case stands on its own. But on the other hand, the historians who say, well, of course, we can't work in any claim to miracle because that's beyond the purview of our discipline. And the answer is, so you don't want to use good empirical method. You want to start by ruling a whole bunch of things out beforehand.
You actually want to start as a rationalist.
Yeah.
And then move to empiricism.
Yeah. You've got Loch Ness Monster and Yeti and all sorts of things that somebody's going to raise their hand and say, what about this?
Right.
And they have a right to do that.
And they ought to do that.
They ought to do it.
Right. Yeah. And on my, when I teach this on the, you know, it's not a downfall, but one of the challenges to empiricism is once, or empirical method, I like that better, is it's once you've locked yourself into this, everything is subject to the method at that point.
Yeah, you can't rule things out beforehand.
Yeah, so whether God exists or Sasquatch exists are both sort of subject to the method.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, time for our break.
Welcome to our break. Today we're going to do a book that we talked about last episode, and it's the newest book published by 1517, or going to be published by 1517 Legacy Project, and it's a Resurrection Fact. This is a book edited by Dr. Francisco.
Our very own Dr. Francisco.
Our very own Dr. Francisco.
And John Bombaro.
And Pastor John Bombaro from down in San Diego.
We should have John on the show one day.
Yeah, we should. I've mentioned it to him, so we will.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great. And that book, last week we talked about how it'll be available in the future. And as of this episode, per everything going right, which I'll follow up and make sure it is, you'll be able to pre-order that book after listening to this show. So I will have a link in the show notes to the book. It'll say The Resurrection Fact on the link, and that'll take you to the 1517 Legacy online store. And from there, you'll be able to click pre-order, fill in your information, type in your credit card, and that book will ship to you the day it comes out, which should be October 31st. Mm-hmm. And on the 31st, it'll be available for actual purchase on our store and available on Amazon for purchase as well. Yeah. So,
you want a quick little blurb on the book?
Let's get it.
The Resurrection... I can't speak today. The Resurrection Fact, Responding to Modern Critics. Last episode, I went over a couple of the chapters, but missed others. A number of the chapters are basic kind of historical apologetics. But we also have three or four chapters that are looking at specific rejections of Christianity, especially rejections of Christianity because of the claim that the resurrection never happened. So you have, you know, I mentioned, I think, last time that you got who's who in the zoo of Lutheran apologists in this text. So you got Mark Pearson, John Barbaro, Craig Parton, Angus Manouge. Angus Manouge has a chapter entitled Justified Belief in the Resurrection, where he looks at the, a lot of contemporary philosophical discussion talks, has this assumption that you really can't have 100% objective knowledge about things, and that's true. What's important epistemologically, since we're talking about that in this episode, is that you just your beliefs are at least justified. There's something backing them up. You're not just believing in things because of your grandma Schmidt told you or what have you. And what Parton does, or what Angus Manouge does, is sets the argument for the resurrection in sort of that philosophical context. There's a chapter, you hear this a lot. I know that there's an internet movie that has went around a couple of years ago now, but it's still around on YouTube, called Zeitgeist, which makes the claim that the story, if you will, of the resurrection is actually just a story developed from earlier resurrection myths from Egyptian mythology and other Mediterranean.
Yes, it's an Osiris.
Exactly. And, C.J. Armstrong and a lawyer, Andrew Deloche, look at that in particular and set the gospel accounts of the resurrection over and against those mythological accounts of a dying and rising God. And then we have, interestingly, I don't know how much this matters so much, but one of our authors is a female apologist, which is kind of unique. Carolyn Hansen from Yale University writes a chapter entitled Tactile and True, the Physicality of the Resurrection, where she deals with the claims amongst especially some of the more liberal variety of New Testament scholars who say that, yes, the early Christians, the first generation of Christians, saw something. But it wasn't the physical Jesus after his crucifixion. It was more of a ghost or an apparition. So
that they touched and ate fish.
So that you've got that and many more chapters, a total of 8 chapters in this text.
That's really interesting, because you'd have to first acknowledge that you believe the accounts that they saw something, but then choose not to believe parts of those accounts.
Yeah. Well, the more you look at it, one of the things we did with this text is, as we're thinking about how to, you know, the strategy of the text is, like making the case for Christianity, we wanted all of our authors to pick up on one particular author and their particular rejection of the resurrection. And when I sat down to think about mine, I just did some basic Google searches, and holy cats, there are just 100 different, I think they're all conspiracies for the most part, because they don't have any facts backing them up, conspiracies on why the tomb was empty. Eventually, I didn't go with those. The conspiracy theories are easy to debunk because they're conspiracy theories, right. But I went with Bart Ehrman and the claim that Dr. Rosenblatt alluded to earlier in the show, that historians are precluded from describing the empty tomb by the resurrection because of this alleged knowledge.
How do historians this miracle?
This assumption that miracles don't happen, or at least they're so unlikely that it's outside the scope of historical research.
Yeah.
I think that's enough. Yeah?
Yeah, that's great. This will be available for pre-order as of listening to this episode at shop.1517legacy.com. And the easiest way, of course, is going to be follow the link in the show notes, which you can find in the description on your podcast app. Or you can find on the website for every episode. And the website gets updated when the episode goes live Friday mornings. So you can go check that out. Let's say you use iTunes for your podcasting app and you hate the way the show notes show up there. A quick Google search to thinkingfellows.com will take you right to the latest episodes.
Boy, that sounds like a lot of work. Who does all that work?
Oh, I don't know. Somebody who sits at this table and doesn't talk. Also, if you want to find out when the show goes up, follow us on Facebook, Twitter. Subscribe using your favorite podcasting app. That's the best way to get the show every week and make sure you don't miss a beat.
Yeah.
All right. why don't we jump back into our epistemologies here?
I want to do one more thing before we, and maybe we'll have time for a couple more things, but at least one more. When I went to Concordia in the 90s, and Adam was there too, I don't know if it was the same for him, but I actually took analytic philosophy with Dr. Rosenblatt before I took analytic philosophy, I think I took apologetics with you first. You introduced this idea to me and to everybody in your classes that at some point in time in the 20th century, there's a movement in philosophy that came along called analytic philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And that for all the good, bad, and otherwise that came out of that movement, there were some very helpful things to the apologist and maybe even to sort of uniquely within religious epistemology to the Christian that came out of that movement. And if I remember it right, it was the idea that we gain knowledge on the whole from being communicated to, and that the analytic philosophers helped by saying that there were three types of sort of statements really,
mm-hmm.
that are given to us, and that they all are trying to communicate truth in one sense or another, but the understanding the different types of statements is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed that whole thing changed my world when you said it. And so I thought it'd be good if, for the sake of our listeners, you could sort of go through that a little bit. The statements are analytic, synthetic, and nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
Within the realm of, and we'll get to this later on, but within the realm of doing the evidential apologetic, I mean, we land wholly on one of those statements, and
yep.
we sort of just go at it as the way that we gain most of our knowledge, and we'll talk about that later. But could you go through those for us?
Well, the movement through which it was popularized was called logical positivism, and the popularizer of it, and a bright popularizer he was A.J. Ayer. And the book was titled Language, Truth, and Logic. Attacks on Christianity prior to this almost all charged that it was false. When the logical positivists came along, and they were no friends of Christianity, they were atheistic to the core and wanted to do what was called an encyclopedia of unified science, which had open door for anything from the hard sciences and a closed door to anything religious. That they just flat out said. Anyway, as this movement developed, the propositions of other than from science, the propositions were evaluated, and some of them, they said, were truth-carrying, and they called them analytic. Think all bachelors are unmarried. You say, well, that's true, and I wouldn't want to go up against it, but it's not very thrilling. It's definitional.
Yeah.
Well, they said those have to be included because from it we get all of mathematics.
I actually used that this past week with the students at the university, and they looked at me like they didn't understand what I was saying.
Uh-huh.
Just kind of quizzical head turn like a puppy that you're trying to teach a new trick. And it was interesting to me because I think that since my time at Concordia in the 90s till now, I think it's interesting how much we've even lost definitions,
yeah.
or definitional truth or axiomatic truth. I mean, because really, that's just an axiomatic statement, right? You're just saying,
sure.
if you know what a bachelor is, you know what an unmarried man is, they're
yep.
one and the same thing.
Yeah, well, that's commentary in the schools, but this isn't the time for that. Then the second type of statement that they allowed is genuinely truth-carrying, they called synthetic. And very simply, that had to do with describing the world as it is by the gathering of knowledge. External knowledge, not internal, none of that, but external knowledge, and that includes all of the sciences. They wanted to say that if done right and well, these things can be trusted. They are not known to a 100% probability or
certainty.
They are known only to probability, but before you say, well, that's no different from Plato's opinion, they said, no, this is a sliding scale. And many times you've got 99 44/100% here. It's a good bet. Others, not so much. But to say something you only know in a probability way, that's the sciences.
Right.
That's the hard sciences.
Right, which is also difficult for the kiddos today because science is communicated, all sciences are communicated to them, as I think, as certainty.
Yeah, not as probability.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a reality. Science is what gives you absolute certainty.
Good.
And really the most important things in the world, your iPhone.
Yeah.
Good.
You know, so it must be right all the time.
Goodness.
So it's settled. Everything's settled.
Everything.
Well, think of the
at all.
For thousands of years we tried to get to that and we got to it with the iPhone.
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, think of the sort of the banter about global warming.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in the UK. I don't know if it was going on when you were there, but when I was, it was going on, and it's settled.
I mean, the incredible
thing.
This is
settled. This isn't probability. This is certainty. It's settled. If you go up against it, you're not only an idiot. But
global warming or climate change?
Well,
whatever.
Same thing.
But the incredible thing is they don't even understand how that happens, though. They don't know. They don't understand the scientific process, and they don't even understand like what it means, like how anybody could claim that there was or wasn't global warming.
There's evidence against global warming, though. So what they did is just change the nomenclature, climate change,
right.
So it covers everything.
Yeah.
So you can still tax people to death.
It's windy, and right? It hasn't been windy for 2 weeks.
Yes, yeah.
Goodness.
Yeah. Oh, it's hot this summer. It must be getting warmer.
Evidence. All right, sorry, Rod, go ahead.
Science.
Well, they said these are the most significant, and they were willing and did describe in detail probability reasoning and external evidence and evaluation of it and so forth, as well they might. Anything that was not analytic or didn't qualify as analytic and did not qualify as synthetic went to the category meaningless. Now, they did not mean that the way a college student says, that doesn't have much meaning for me. It was more objective. Think wastebasket category. That is, if it's neither analytic nor synthetic, it's not worth the time of day to give energy to. Why? Because it's neither true nor false, or both true and false, however you want to say it.
Or true or false, but just not verifiable.
Yeah, if in principle there's nothing that can be brought to bear either definitionally or evidentially, pro or con, the logical positivist said it's not worth spending time on. Now that was what you picked up on as we did that analysis in class. This can be tremendously helpful in the religious discussion. In the earliest days, these guys were around the table with some contemporary Christian theologians, and they cleaned the theologians' clocks.
I bet.
Just cleaned their clocks. I'm thinking of Flewen McIntyre's earliest book back in the 50s. their editors. But think of this as applied to religious claims that always come down to internal verification. These guys would say, can you give us anything in addition to that? You know, that you had a liver shiver when you first became a Hindu. And if they can't give anything objective, the analytic philosopher is going to say, that's not worth my time a day.
Right. Montgomery's example, right, is when we say that most religious statements are meaningless or nonsensical in nature. He uses the toasted cheese sandwich God that,
right,
you know, resides behind a planet just outside the reach of the most technologically advanced telescope.
Yep.
And every time we get a better telescope, the toasted cheese sandwich God moves, right? He's farther away.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in him, and I believe he'll deliver me toasted cheese sandwiches anytime I'm hungry.
Yep.
So much so does he gift me with these cheese sandwiches that I'd do anything for him, even though we could never verify.
Yep.
Yeah. So
now the one exception, of course, is Christianity.
Right.
Where the claim is of an incarnation where you could get a look.
Right. And so this discussion is interesting because when you actually get into an apologetic conversation with an unbeliever, I think 9 times out of 10, they're making meaningless statements while expecting analytic truth out of Christianity.
Yes.
In other words, they're making statements about their feelings while at the same time expecting that Christianity rise to the level of geometry.
Yep.
You know, that you can do, or mathematics generally, that you can lay out some sort of formula that's 100% true 100% of the time.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you come along, and Adam and I were talking about this the other day because he has an opportunity for a speaking event where he gets to use a text, which is probably rare for you, right? It would be for me, yeah. And we were talking about which text, and I said, I think what you picked is going to be great. But I said I'd use 1 Corinthians 15 because over and over and over and over again in that chapter of 1 Corinthians, what you get are synthetic statements.
Yep.
You know, you get statements of, this is what I saw, this is what I heard, this is who told it to me.
Yep.
This is what they saw available, at least at that time, available to verification.
Yep.
But of course, not 100% certainty.
Yeah.
Right? You're never going to get to that level.
Anybody in the sciences recognizes that immediately. It's those who aren't in the sciences that don't.
Right. Mm. Well, the important thing oftentimes is to, when discussing this with a non-Christian, is to point out, listen, most of the choices, if not the great majority of the choices that you make in your everyday life, you do not make on the basis of 100% certainty.
Yeah.
You make them based on information of a synthetic nature that's given to you.
Yeah. Dr. Montgomery used to use stepping off the curb in California when there are Porsches about. What are your chances?
Right. Well, I do that too, and I kind of take it to an extreme and say, well, not extreme, but ask them to recount when they learned to cross the street for the first time when they were small.
Right.
What is it that probably their mom did? Took them by their little hand, yep. Had them approach the curb.
Yep.
Very carefully, you were to look left, you know, and make sure that it was clear. You were to look right, make sure it was clear. Then you even looked left again to verify synthetically that a car was not coming. And then you take that first perilous step off the curb into the dangerous street based not on the certainty that a idiot teenager isn't going to come greening around the corner at 80 miles an hour and take you out, but based on the probability that once having analyzed the evidence that you'll cross safely.
Yeah. Right. It's a perfectly good illustration.
Yeah. So where does this leave us with this whole discussion?
Well, it leaves us with, I think, at least this. Christianity is in great shape to be defended factually, and other religions aren't. The East, you can forget. If these are the criteria, the East is going to end up doing ethics and only ethics and... If that's your interest, fine. But if you're talking about religious knowledge, it's probably not going to qualify. It lessens or makes fewer the number of candidates that are realistic on the board, worth spending time to evaluate. And that's why a person should start with Christianity. You may not end up a Christian, but start with it because in principle, it could be overthrown factually.
Right. Is there anything that could be said to make you doubt your belief?
Yeah.
Right.
And I can specify that from 1 Corinthians 15.
Right.
If Christ wasn't raised on the third day after being crucified, I'm probably no longer a Christian.
Right. The uniqueness to Christianity is that it rests on an event that actually happened in real time, real space, real history.
Yep.
And was recorded by real people.
Yep.
And then the question becomes, was their record of the event accurate or not?
Yep.
My dad told me a story once when he used to teach Sunday school, and I'm probably getting the details confused, but it was maybe a junior high Sunday school. It was Easter morning, and he goes into the classroom and says, "Did you all hear they found the bones of Jesus? Isn't this great? We know he really existed." And everybody's like, "Yeah, yeah." He's like, "No, this is true. You shouldn't be here in the first place."
Exactly.
But that sort of point, I think, needs to be made time and again, that our faith is contingent upon a real resurrection.
Yeah.
Right, time and again.
And that Christianity can be proven false.
Yep.
Right.
In principle.
And that in principle. And that's actually its greatest strength.
Yep.
In comparison to, you know, you mentioned Hinduism, Buddhism, and all these others. But even, say, Mormonism or Islam, these religions that are dressed up historically, but you start looking at them, there's not a shred of Islam's a little different, but for Mormonism, not a shred of evidence.
Yep.
And even Islam is pretty weak when it comes to the evidence. There's the only one that passes muster is Christianity.
Yeah, that's for the non-Christian or the skeptic who's thinking of maybe looking into religion, this is the rationale for start with Christianity. Don't do it alphabetically.
Right.
And the reason is that here you can overthrow it. It can be overthrown factually.
Well, and at least start with the one that claims that something actually happened.
Yes.
Right? In yes. real time, real space, real mm-hmm. history.
Yep.
And I think you're right, Adam. We have to drown that. We have to just like pound that home time and time mm-hmm. again. That was the big trap that Ken Ham fell into when he did his debate with Bill Nye.
Yes.
Bill Nye point blank asks him, is there anything that would cause you to give up the faith?
There it is.
And he said no.
Yep.
I mean, he flatly said no.
Yep.
Now, I commend him for getting into that debate, and he I'm not trying to attack him at all, but he fell into a trap.
Yep.
And I don't know what his background is, but this type of training in some analytic philosophy, in the evidential argument, you won't stumble over yourself, your own tongue like that.
Yeah. If we even, in our particular Lutheran church, trained the high schoolers in prep for college on just that, the answer to that Phil prof who says to you, is there anything that would cause you to unbelieve in Jesus? The answer is yes, not no. And it's in 1 Corinthians 15.
Right, right. We should at one point in time, Caleb, have Kurt and Debbie Winrich on the show and talk about what they do with the high schoolers over at Faith Chapo.
Sure, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been doing it for more than a decade. They're doing exactly that, teaching high schoolers to answer those questions when they get to the university.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I think that's what we have for today, right?
Yep, that about wraps up the show. Make sure to go like us on Facebook, rate the show on iTunes if you're enjoying it, or leave us a comment on your favorite episode at thinkingfellows.com, or send us an email at thinkingfellows@1517legacy.com.
Thank you.
See you next time.